to the next in our series of What's Next in Corporate Real Estate. I'm delighted today for a couple of reasons. Firstly, this is the launch rather of our new series, which is going to be about leadership. And with that, I have great pleasure in welcoming to our studio at Cushman & Wakefield, Ben Armand, the Global Head of Property at Pearson. Welcome, Ben.
Welcome. Yeah, good. Glad to be here.
Good. Thanks for coming. The point of this series of podcasts is going to be around leadership, and we'll get to that in a little bit and what we mean by leadership within the CRE function. But before we do, maybe we could just start at the beginning and talk a little bit about going to university, what you studied there, and then what happened after that.
Yeah, I think my career's been quite an untraditional route into real estate, probably. I've had, I think of it more as a connected series of learnings as opposed to some kind of specific plan to get where I am today. To give you a quick overview, my best subject at school was maths, but I then actually did modern languages. I also did a chemistry degree thrown in. I ended up doing French and Latin at university. I then became an accountant, quickly joined investment banking and worked through various products, ultimately being a COO, where I looked after transformation of portfolios, including real estate. Then set up my own consultancy business, and now I'm basically the head of real estate at Pearson. So, you know, bounced around a bit, lots of different things.
So if we just talk a little bit, so you're at university, you're doing French and Latin, you're good at maths, so you can do anything by the sounds of it. Your first job out of university was in the banking world?
Yeah, it's fair to say, you know, a little bit about my own background is, I've often said this story, my mother's favourite book was The Family from One End Street, if you know, is about a very large, happy family where the mother was a washerwoman and the father was a dustman. And that was essentially my life, probably until about 11. My dad was an electrical engineer, took his degree at night school, and, you know, later on became a maths teacher. And so that was quite a big influence for me growing up. You know, I think he got his degree when I was about 9 as to sort of the effort you had to put into it. So if truth be told, I've been asked this question obviously a lot in my career, desire for financial stability was actually quite high up on my list when I, you know, was looking for a career. So no surprise I went straight into investment banking. And, you know, yes, certainly money doesn't make you happy. I think we've all learned that. But what I often say is, you know, let's not be too busy planning for our future not to enjoy the present. And I've had the pleasure of being able to enjoy quite a lot of things over the years. So that's primarily why I went into banking. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed banking a lot. You know, my degree, as you know, is Latin, which is really like doing a series of complex crosswords every day. And when I did audit, when I joined Ernst & Young, I was put on all the new assignments, so anything that didn't have a precedent. So I found I was drawn to the complex. I love the complex. So when I got into banking, quickly got into derivatives and spent a lot of my time there looking at, you know, volatility and yield curves and repo trading and securities lending, some really complex things, working with some incredibly bright people. And I actually really enjoyed banking. I worked for 4 different banks for 30 years. And, you know, that was really what drove me. That was an environment in which I really enjoyed.
So you mentioned a part of that was real estate, and maybe we'll come back to that. But let's talk a little bit, let's sort of jump in the deep end. Let's talk a little bit about leadership within banks, because I think we've all read books or watched The Wolf of Wall Street or have an idea about what working in any investment bank is like. So can you maybe describe the culture and maybe more importantly, what you learned about leading teams, people, working with more senior people, working with more junior people?
Well, I think we probably should define what we mean by leadership before we start talking about it. I think, you know, I think I want to start by what I think it's not. Mm-hmm. You know, leadership to me is not management. So, I mean, I think it was Steve Jobs who said that, you know, management is probably about persuading people to do things they don't want to do. But leadership is about inspiring people to do the things they never thought they could. So to me, leadership is not about, you know, setting deadlines and savings and targets and filling out spreadsheets and expenses. That's sort of management, which is important and needs to be done. I think if you read everywhere about what is leadership, everyone will tell you that real leadership is all about people. And for me, you know, connecting people, empowering, developing people, making people be the best that they can be, their best selves, celebrating their success, and essentially creating a platform on which those people can be the best that they can be. So that, to me, was the fundamentals. But I think more recently, I'm not sure leadership is all about people, because I think increasingly, particularly when we look at real estate, when we look at, you know, the way particularly, say, the workplace is changing, then I think leadership is also, maybe modern leadership, is about identifying the need and deriving opportunities from change. I guess some might call that a vision. But, you know, strong management skills to lead people through change, lead your teams, through clients, stakeholders, employees. And I think to be a successful leader, you've got to what I call engage, motivate and inspire people to be able to effectively implement change. So that's a huge piece for me of what leadership is about, particularly in the real estate world.
As you're kind of growing up through the career that you had in banking, and then we can come on and specifically talk about Pearson, hopefully, and some of the stuff that you've done recently, which I'm really interested to talk to you about. Do you think you learn good leadership by watching other people, by having mentors? I mean, what's your advice to people who are quarter, half of the way through their career, who are thinking that they want to end up in a leadership position without having to go through, because you don't get formally trained to be a leader. We all know we'd learn it on the job, but that's really vague, saying you learn it on the job. What is it that you've done in your career or seen that you think is, oh yeah, I did that and that helped me?
To me, I think, you know, I guess there are three fundamental values. I mean, the easy thing about thinking about leadership is how you want your leaders to treat you, and therefore how you get the best out of yourself is, you know, highly probably going to be exactly the way you should treat other people. So to me, I've come up with three real values that I think are really important to me in leaders, and they are trust, respect and freedom. And I think in a commercial sense, in a business context, freedom is really empowerment. So to me, I think it's all about how you explore those three things and what they actually mean for you. So, you know, trust for me is, a lot of people say everything starts with trust. You know, all relationships are with trust. But I think for me, you have to explore first that trust and integrity are obviously very entwined. Mm-hmm. So if you think of integrity as essentially trusting yourself and always doing the right thing, you know, whether anyone's watching or not, because clearly if you're trying to build trust with people who don't have integrity, that's going to be a problem. So I think, you know, everything starts with integrity. And once you've got that, I think a couple of things that I think really builds trust. One is delivering on your promises. So one thing I've always tried to do is, you know, and we do set some fairly ambitious targets in my teams, but today we've always been able to deliver on them. So I think, you know, demonstrate that you've got the required capabilities to understand and deliver. I think that's a really important part of trust. And as I say, you know, follow that up with actions. But I think the other part of trust, which is not just about actions and deliveries, is creating an environment, a cultural environment, in which failure is acceptable. Michael, as you know very well, my sport is judo, and I coach a couple of times a week on this. So, you know, I'm going to have a lot of stories today from that sport. And a really good story I want to share with you about why this is important to me is, you know, my son, I've got three sons. The youngest has had the benefit of a few more years of my coaching. He's double national champion. And the first time he won his national medal was very interesting, because in the first competition, he was English champion. He lost to the Scottish champion in the first fight. He went all the way through the competition because, you know, it was a little pool. He managed to win the other two fights and get into the knockout stage. And when he got to the final, he met the same boy. And he came to me and he said, "Dad, I've watched this boy all day and I know how he wins. He wins by getting them on the ground. So in the final, I'm not going to go on the ground. I'm just going to get a score. And I'm going to basically mess around and you'll get penalties for not attacking. But as long as I don't get three in those days, I'll win." Not necessarily the best judo, but I'm like, fine, it's the national final if that's what you want to do. And this is what he did. And he won. He got a score. He messed around. He got two penalties for not attacking. The time finished and he won. It was his first national championship. And, you know, the story on the way home, we were talking about this. And I said, you know what? Not only is failure important, but in your case and in many cases in business, failure is absolutely essential. Because if you hadn't actually failed in that first fight, you'd have been coming home with a silver medal. So, you know, and that's what I say to people in the environment we try to get. And another way of looking at it in business, I often say, if you're achieving 6 out of 10 and you try for 8 and get 7, do you feel you lost one or gained one? And the job of a leader, in my opinion, is really twofold, right? Firstly, encourage your people. They've gained one. So give them that kind of support. But you want to leave them a little bit with a sense that they lost one as well. So that gives them this drive to go forward. And again, this motto comes from judo. One of the judo mottos from Professor Kano, who's the inventor of judo. He says that it's not important to be better than other people, only better than yesterday. And, you know, it's not always striving for excellence. It's not an easy way to live your life. You know, my teams know it's not an easy thing to do. But I think that ability to, on the one hand, praise yourself for what you've achieved, but also want to do more. And I think that if you can create that environment in your organizations, you're going to build a lot of trust, because that allows people to have conversations, to say the wrong thing, to get it wrong. And through that process, you will get better results.
Yeah, and there's a whole bunch of things that you've touched on there, which I think are fascinating. I think the story about your son, but it for me kind of resonates with that there's always more than one way of getting to the desired end game. And I mean, what he did was thought, I probably won't get there by doing what I always do, so I've now got to do something different. But he only figured that out by spending a lot of time watching, in this case, one particular boy fight and figuring out how he was winning. So, I mean, I've made that mistake many times, but you have that fear that, you know, you think you know how to do it and it's easier. the easiest thing to do today is what you did yesterday and try and do it a little bit better. Well, and actually the better thing to do is to take a step back and go, you know what, maybe there's a completely different way of approaching this problem.
Yeah.
And that brings the whole question of diversity of people in your business and the way you approach things. But actually, let's approach this from a different angle and think about it in a way I'm not comfortable necessarily doing. But if it gets me the result I need, then I need to force myself to do something that I'm not typically going to do. That's really hard.
And I think as leaders, to help people through that process so they're not disheartened, because of many days when I know my team's come to me and say, oh, you know, we're trying to deliver so much. So you have to sometimes stop on those plateaus and look down and look around and see where you've come from and see what you've achieved. Celebrate success is really important in the process. But then we get up again, you know. And I've had judo competitions where we've traveled to Europe and we've spent an absolute fortune and we've spent 17 hours on one trip. And in judo, you can lose literally in 3 seconds.
Yeah.
And we've come all the way back. And, you know, on Monday night, we're back at training. We have a saying in judo that we win our medals in club and we go to competitions to collect them.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, work is the same thing. You have to do in a huge amount of effort that people don't always see. You put that effort in, if you do it well, you know, the results will come. But, you know, there are days as in my sport where you just have to get up and you carry on.
One of the other things you mentioned in that description you just had was the ability of leaders to understand how to set goals that are people nowadays call stretch targets, but have an idea or have a set of goals which seem too difficult to the individual, but are achievable by the collective, which is back to the team. I mean, I see too many leaders doing things one by one with people, and I don't think that's nearly as effective as getting a team working for you. And understanding that the sum of the parts is greater than the individual, which I guess is the analogy. So how in a leadership capacity, you're managing up into the C-suite, you know what the ambition of the business is. Quite often they set goals that, as real estate people would say, are totally unrealistic. They don't understand our business. We can't do that. Yet you've got to deliver them. And you've got to somehow get that team to want to try, even if individually they think they can't get there.
I think there's a difference between different styles of leadership, what I call sort of inclusive leadership for, you know, where you're working with your teams, but there are probably different styles of leadership that you do for managing, as you say, the C-suite. But I think before we come on to that, I think we should just have a little think about also about the respect piece, because that's another important part, how you, you know, part of building the teams. Because I think, again, with the respect piece, there's two parts to it, you know, that you can get respect through what you do, so achievements, but also how you do it. And I've worked in, as you know, from investment banking, Pearson did, and worked, you know, with clients in different businesses. And I think, you know, the balance that people put on those two things is actually quite important.
Mm.
So, you know, some organizations will say what you do is important and how you do it is more important. You know, many organizations put them a sort of equal footing, and some organizations will have their cultural, official cultural values as equal footing. But, you know, when I was on the trading floor, it was all about outcomes. And quite frankly, they often didn't care how you got there. So, you know, obviously the organizations I worked in are very different. So I think, you know, in terms of showing respect through your achievements is, as I said, you know, actually delivering what you said. But respecting people through behaviors to me is about choice, which is, again, very interesting when we're now looking at, you know, the real estate space, the changes of the office and workspace. It's a lot about choice and flexibility. So I think, you know, it's about allowing people to achieve through choice. People want to choose how they work, who they work with, where they work. And I think as a leader, you know, I guess this comes on to the whole concept I've got around empowerment. I mean, as you know, I've worked, you know, I was thinking about this coming into your talk today. I have not had a boss in my same location for 26 years. And I've managed global teams for longer than that. So the concept of remote leadership, which is different, obviously, for the way you manage that from people within your own physical location, is a huge piece about empowerment. And, you know, strong leaders who are very good and understand the concepts of empowerment will have no problem managing, you know, remote teams. And this is where I come back to, you know, I said this freedom, the freedom of allowing your people to say, to choose how they work, where they work, who you work with, and the type of things they do. So as part of a leadership, I said at the beginning, creating these platforms, I don't really tell my people what to do. They tell me what to do. That's why I hired them.
Mm.
And we're creating platforms, you know, for them to do it. So one of the things I talk about related to this is the difference between empowerment and responsibility. So real empowerment, as I say, is creating those platforms. You often hear people say about, I give you responsibility. Now, you know, in my view, you can never give anyone responsibility. Responsibility is always taken. You give empowerment and then people have to take responsibility, and the two go hand in hand. So, you know, that's an important sort of differentiator. And I would say to people, if any of your leaders or bosses say, I'm giving you responsibility, then pull them up, because it's not their choice, it's yours.
Yeah. I think I, in a rather unflattering way, say, I ask for forgiveness, not permission, which is not quite what you mean, but yes, there is something about moving on with your career when you just have to get off and do what you think the right thing is.
Sometimes you have to do that as well.
There is a real truth, which is you need to get on and do what you want to do and you're good at, and you know that it's helping everyone else within the framework that you've been set under whoever's in charge, and keep them informed. But, you know, leaders tend to, I mean, I've found it's much harder to, you know, you can leave the really good people alone to get on and do what they do well because they need less management, back to your earlier comment, but they still need leadership, because if all the attention's going to the problem area of the business or the problem people, they're getting a disproportionate amount of time from the leader.
Well, yeah.
So that's another really hard thing, I think, in leadership, is to balance those
What I think you're touching on is, you know, obviously be careful they're not over-empowerment. You know, I had a leader once who said to me, the secret of my success is to hire really good people and leave them to get on with it, which is, you know, it's quite admirable. I mean, he's, you know, got a lot of trust in there. The problem with that is when the people don't deliver, you're still accountable for it.
Yeah.
So you can't ever delegate accountability. So, you know, I have this concept around trust and control. Again, it goes back to my, we'll talk about power, direction and control in judo terms in a minute. But
I think I'm going to get wrestled to the floor.
Between trust and control. So if you think about the extremes, I love doing extremes. You know, life is normally somewhere grey in the middle, right? But if you think about extremes, you know, absolute trust is no control at all. And absolute control is no trust at all. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the reality is, in leadership is a balance, and how much trust and how much control you decide to operate in any scenario is different on individuals, whether they're remote or local, and all the different things you do. But I would say as leaders, be cautious, because if you are erring too much on the control side, you're giving the impression of not trusting. Mm-hmm. And equally, if you're going so much down the trust side, you could be at personal risk. So just be, you know, careful how that works.
Well, you could be at personal risk, but I think even more important is the, if you're not doing that with a plan and as part of a team, you can be doing really good work and getting the output, but it's not as good as it could be because you're not aligned with everything else that's going on. So I still think, as a however senior you are, you need to feel part of something bigger or greater than what you're just delivering. So for me, one of the key areas of leadership is building a team that has a strategy or a vision that's going to go beyond what they can do individually, but as a collective, and it's more fun as well. I mean, we all want to work with other people, and we all want to do better than we think we can. And I've found the only way that happens is when you're working alongside and as part of a team, not as an individual.
Yeah, I think, and also it's becoming increasingly more important, right? Because I hear a lot of people, and I've said it myself, joking about how my six-year-old knows, you know, technology and social media better than I do, but she actually does, right? So, and as the generations come into the office, they will increasingly know a lot more about a lot of things than we can ever do. So I think our role as leaders is fundamentally changing, and you've got to be very careful. They've got to, you know, resist the temptation to tell people how to do their jobs. You know, because quite often we're going to have a lot less knowledge than they have. And so it's, you know, we're creating, as I say, the platforms on which, and using our connections and other things to actually make the work happen, as you say, building that team. And so back to the old adage, we hire good people, you know, for them to tell us what to do, not the other way around. So I think you'll be cautious on that.
One of the conversations we've had in the past, and again, this relates to judo, which I know is a huge passion of yours, and you spend a lot of time coaching people, is this idea of power, direction, and control. So maybe people understand how that might apply in a business setting. Can you kind of explain what it is? And maybe we could take that as part of this workshop that you ran. What's the thinking behind that in relation to that workshop?
Yeah, it comes from, I've written a course, a leadership course called Judo Values for Business. I've actually delivered it twice. It's a practical course. It takes executives and needs a legal sign-off for you to participate in a little bit of judo. And I did it actually in North Carolina, so I got through, you know, US law, so that was quite good. And also we did it in London. And it takes people through the concept of judo, from creating safe environments, taking a grip, you know, commitment, through to transitions, and it applies it all to a business context. But the specific piece that you mentioned, called power, direct, control, is about the grip. Obviously in judo, two players have to actually grip, and you know, when I coach children, they often think gripping is holding on. Gripping is not holding on. In judo, it has a very specific reason and the objective, and that is power, direction, and control. You have to throw somebody specifically onto their back. And the way when I lecture about this and talk about this from a leadership point of view, power in a business context is like the ideas, the creativity, the excitement. And whether you're running a meeting or a project or even, you know, in your whole department, you've got to create an environment in which power, you know, is free flowing. And that's great. But obviously, and we demonstrate this on the judo mat, if you just have power alone, you just drag each other all over the mat and everyone gets very hot and nothing very much achieved. You obviously need direction and control. If you have power and direction, obviously I throw somebody, but they fly off the mat, but they're not on their back. There's no score. And then myself and some of the other black belts show what it looks like, power, direction, control, and it's usually quite effective and a bit of fun. So from a business point of view, the direction obviously is the purpose, and the control is, you know, someone's got to take the minutes and the agendas and follow up the actions. So my teams, again, know whether it's in a meeting or whether it's in a project or whatever we're doing, you know, you have to have all three. And without power, direction and control, you're not going to achieve your objectives. And I've seen many meetings where everybody talks, lots of creative ideas, and then everyone gets up and leaves.
Yep.
And I've
been in many of those, many hours.
I've also seen meetings where there's so much structure and control that nobody really says anything because no one's been given that environment. You know, no one's created a safe environment in which they want to compete, as it were. So, you know, that's a concept that I've obviously taken from judo, which I've found incredibly effective. So my team know that all my meetings basically have that concept to them, that there has to be all three, otherwise they won't be successful.
Yeah, and I love that idea of the power part of that, of it being about a diverse team of people who feel totally at ease saying what they want to say to get to the best outcome, rather than it being dominated by someone running the meeting, telling everyone, which is the power and the control part.
Yeah, and also that diversity of different opinions, again, coming back to the remote working, is important. So one of the, you know, mistakes that I learnt myself when I was first running remote teams is you're sitting in London with eight people and you go round that table and then you go to New York and then you go to Asia, and an hour later you're getting to somebody who's probably English isn't as strong as yours on a crackly line. And so again, it's a simple thing, but when we have global meetings, there's never a standard order. No one knows who's coming next.
Yeah.
You know. So again, it's just that kind of ways of engaging people and ways of getting people involved.
And that sounds like my meetings, lack of control.
Yeah.
You're doing it deliberately, I'm not. I think one of the other things I'd like to touch on, and in a way maybe we can use this to pull a lot of these themes and thoughts together, is recently you very kindly invited me to your Workplace of the Future event. I mean, it was interesting on many levels. I think I'm pretty sure I'm right in saying if you weren't the first, you're one of very few companies who have invited in a cross-section of the business of real estate, to a workshop free of charge in which you put on a lot of interesting speakers to frame something that you're interested in as a business to get the wider view as to where we're going as an industry. And I guess for me, that threw up a whole bunch of questions. As you know, the obvious one is, why did you do it? And then why did you do it in that format? Because I think that says a lot about leadership. And then I think maybe if we start with that, and then I wanted to dive into how can we take real estate and use it in this leadership way? What's the connection between how we're now designing and using workspace and how we encourage the leadership that we're talking about?
No, it's good that you raised it and you came. Thanks for coming to the summit. But as you know, and I'll cover some of the things we said. I mean, as I said at the summit, Pearson aren't leading this because we're experts in workplace or because we've got an answer. Clearly not. We are in the process of starting a big headquarters project, which will last into 21. So it's on our minds and it's important to us. But also, we're an education company. So we spend a lot of our time looking at the future of work, because that's going to determine, you know, where we're going to be as a business. So, you know, the future work is changing. You know, Pearson recently issued their first global learner survey, which is a research paper. I think we had 11,000 learners across 19 countries exploring the future of education in each of their countries, what learning means to them, specifically focused on sort of technology and work. There were a lot of really good takeaways, if people want to find that and read it, literally for all of us, because for learners, teachers, parents in particular, looking at actually, you know, how this is going to affect our children in the future.
Yeah, and just to interrupt you for a second, we'll put that in the notes, because that I was lucky enough to be at your supplier conference and heard the person at Pearson who did that talk about it. And there's some really interesting stuff about the future of work. And by that, you're talking about what jobs will exist and what jobs, by definition, won't exist. You can access that via the web. So
yeah,
we'll add that in at the end for people to go to. Really good piece of research.
Yeah, I think it's an excellent piece of work. But, you know, I said, you know, for all of us, for taking the educational part of it, which is important to all of us. But obviously, I had a real estate lens as well in reading that. So whenever I read a lot of the research papers that Pearson produce, I'm also always putting a real estate lens. What does this mean for workplace as well as for the future of work? So two specific takeaways I took from that paper, which weren't actually a surprise to me. People increasingly expect technology to be at the heart of learning experience. Yep. And I think people increasingly expect technology to be at the heart of the workplace as well. That hasn't changed.
Yep.
And they want technology to make learning and work more interesting and engaging. And that's what we have to do in the workplace as well. So I think if you think of it from that perspective, the purpose of the workplace is changing. We're in the process at Pearson of establishing a sort of strategic vision for our workplace. I've got the CEO, you know, the CFO, the CIO involved in this conversation, and we still haven't quite evolved the words, so I have some titles that I'm working with. But essentially, we want to make the office a place of learning. And we believe that people come to work to improve their own lives and the lives of other people through the work that they do. If you have that concept, and I'm sure we're going to end up putting some far better words to that aspiration than I've been able to articulate here, but it does mean that the nature of the office has got to change. So if the purpose of the office is changing and it will simply become another place of learning, then the design of the workplace also has to change. Because, you know, we all, in the whole industry has been talking about experience-based workplaces. As you know, we raised this at the summit. My view is that whilst we all know we need to build experience-based workplaces because of the changing nature of flexibility and choice that's coming in, and we talk about that being, you know, a millennial thing, right? They may have initiated it, but quite frankly, we all want flexibility and choice now. This is a good thing,
true.
Right?
Yep.
Having worked for 30 years in investment banking, I embrace this quite a lot. So I think workplace design is going to work. But my view, and maybe it's a little bit different, is that we also need to change the nature of the way we deliver projects. So some of the projects I've been on that we have an experience-based end game in terms of the physical design we want to have, but then we have a traditional approach to real estate projects. And what I mean by that is most people, when they approach change, we have an iterative way of thinking about it based on our current knowledge of what we do. So an iterative version of what we know today. But if we're going to have an experience-based solution, we have to have an experience-based project. So what we've done at Pearson is we've created a whole new phase at the beginning, which was an 8-week program, which we rolled out called the Workplace Innovation Program, where we stopped people talking about assets. Stop telling me how many desks you need and how many meeting rooms you need. Stop talking about assets and tell me about experience. Tell me how you need to work. And we broke down the experience into 5 areas, which is entering the building, focused work, collaborative work, amenities, and what we call communication channels, which is not communication between people, that's collaboration. It's how you communicate to the building, how the building communicates to you.
Right.
And, you know, there's a whole conversations around that. So when we're getting into the team levels, we're saying that's the vision is office as a place of learning. The process is basically looking at it in terms of 5 experiences, and that's what we're doing. When we come to the team conversations, which we still assess how they do their work today, etc., but it's not for them to tell us to say how many screens and desks and pedestals they want. It's to tell us how they work. So we would look at things like focus working. What does focus working mean for your team? Now, as you know, I worked on a trading floor for 25 years, so I can sit in an open plan and I can focus work with lots of noise flying around because that's my experience. I know some people would need headphones and some people need to physically move to a new location. So we all need focus working, but the way we actually need to focus work is personal. And so this is all about giving choice. And the process we've got at Pearson by taking people through this experience-based project approach, where we took people to look at physical buildings and we, you know, read articles and we did workshops and we worked with them, has been really useful.
And I think, sorry to interrupt you, but I think what you're talking about is it's a really interesting idea, and it's quite subtle in a way, which is this: when you say you've got to stop talking about physical assets and start talking about what people are actually doing. It's kind of at 2 levels. One, as you've said, it's at the individual level, which makes it much more complicated. So we can't design something that is the same for everyone globally. But the second thing, which I think is equally interesting, is this idea that we all have a different type of work we do, and what is it we need to do it really well. And only when you start with that, as opposed to finish with it, I think a lot of design is done around, as you say, physical assets, so how many meeting rooms, some open space, some closed space. But it's not actually, it's beginning to tackle what people do and how they work in a modern way. But actually what you've said is you've started at a different place,
yeah.
Which I tie back to leadership in the sense that, you know, strong leaders will say, no, actually the way we've done it for the last 5-10 years is evolving too slowly. We need a radical rethink. And you guys need to get on board with this, and this is how we're going to think about it. And then you've got to bring everyone along for the journey.
Yeah, and particularly you've mentioned the C-suite, particularly the C-suite as you go along. So, you know, as you know, at Pearson, when I joined, I split the strategy into two phases, what I called the portfolio transformation, which was, it was about reducing costs and space and all the usual stuff we have to do. And we improved a lot of workplaces along the way. But I essentially commandeered the capital budget. And if you weren't doing a project that was going to actually hit the bottom line, then, you know, it was stopped for 3 years. And we had a huge benefit to the way we did that. But we hadn't really spent a lot of time, because we didn't have the capital to do so, about experience-based workplaces. We were getting nicer, improved offices, but it wasn't really that focused. We're now coming out of that phase. You know, we've reduced the corporate offices globally in Pearson from over 220 to under 80 by the end of this year. So that is a substantial improvement on the utilization, number of properties, costs, everything else. But now we're focused on what I call the workplace transformation. And that is re-looking at our workplaces, so saying, okay, they're great, they're nice, but actually, are they really going to attract and retain talent? And are they really enabling people to produce their best performance? And that is what we're looking at sort of in the London project, which is, you know, we're sort of prototyping this on the biggest project we'll ever do. And then we're going to downscale it.
That's your project. So that's, I think, that's leadership for you.
just go for
go
it.
Go big
just
or go home, yeah.
But I think it's funny, you know, when you talked about going back to the C-suite, you know, how did we get the right to do this? And I know from talking to some of my peers in the organisation, sort of getting CRE heads as a seat at the table that can actually do this. And Pearson's a great organisation from that perspective, because it's very open and there's very, you know, conversations and, you know, the door's open for these conversations. But I think we talked about collaborative leadership, which I say I think is more about how we engage teams and engaging, you know, at that level. But I think we've got a different style of leadership maybe we should talk about when we're talking about engaging senior people to, you know, to give us the keys to the door, to allow us to play, as I often say.
Yeah, and I think coming up at the end of the time we have, so maybe let's just spend the last couple of minutes talking about that. So you've talked a lot about, as you said, running teams, and we've talked about what you're doing at Pearson with this workplace of the future, which I think demonstrates really interesting leadership across the industry. So now let's talk about how someone like you, Ben, thinks through and talks to the leadership who basically control the purse strings and have a vision for the business, and you have to fit into that and they have to see the benefit of what you're doing.
Yeah, I think to me, I've thought about this a couple of different styles. One I call strategic leadership, there's one I call decisive leadership, and the other one is persuasive leadership. So there's slightly different focuses, but, you know, strategic leadership is about creating that necessary, you know, people call about gravitas and the communication, really from a real estate point of view, to be treated as equals. You know, let's be honest, the heads of finance, technology, HR, legal are already there, okay? Quite often in the real estate space, we're not quite there. We don't quite report through, or we're not able to get through the door. And, you know, earlier in my career, I kept hearing the word the business this, the business that. You know, I am the business. I decide on real estate. So I think it's, you know, getting away from the business decides and, you know, the facilities teams put things in place to what the CRE function can do. And it was interesting when I joined Pearson, obviously I set up meetings with all the senior presidents of the businesses, and, you know, I was about a few weeks in meeting some of them, and I was brave enough to say, it's interesting, you know, about the third conversation I've had here. And, you know, when you hire IT guys, you tell them which service to build, and when you hire finance guys, do you tell them which accounting rules to follow, because everyone keeps telling me which buildings to buy. And there was a bit of a joke and laugh. And we set up, you know, an executive committee where now everybody joins every month and we talk about real estate issues. And, you know, one of my colleagues said, it's great. It's like a ringside seat, your meeting, because, you know, we drive accountability and commitment. And I guess it comes back from, you know, my judo background. As you know, I spend my entire life in conflict. And by conflict, I don't mean confrontation. I mean constructive conflict. And, you know, we get two people getting on a mat, really trying to push each other to their absolute best and actually trying to get the right result. And then afterwards we bow, we come off and we go down the pub together and we're great friends. And by bringing that into the office, to saying, you know, what I call conflict, which is creating an environment, a platform in which people feel very comfortable to explore their opinions so that you get proper commitment, is absolutely essential. And all my meetings do that.
Yeah, and I think that's probably quite a rare quality, because it's hard in businesses to get people to express their views, particularly if they're not. It's easier to agree with everyone and move along than it sometimes is to hold an opposing view. And that is, again, another very good side of leadership, having an environment where people aren't criticized for holding a different opinion.
And that also comes on then to making decisions. You know, again, I work on premise that the leader always knows what they do, even when they don't. Okay, yeah. And, you know, this whole ability, so I've thought a lot about that in my career. So how does a leader who has to make decisions minimize the chances that he's wrong? And to me, it's come down to two things. It's come down to data and communication. So I spend a lot of my time looking at data, making sure I have access to data. We have some great data at Pearson, and I have a sort of a head of governance and data, you know, that brings all this to the table, and we've got lots of access to that. So it's being on top of that. And communication is talking to a lot of people. all the time, so you know the business context, so that when you're having to make a quick decision, if you've got a very good sense of the data and you've got a very good sense of where people want to be, you know, you're going to minimize the chance of making those decisions incorrectly.
Ben, it's been a fascinating conversation. I think we could probably talk for hours and hours, but unfortunately we can't. What I'd love to do is kind of wrap it up there. I'm not sure that either of us can necessarily summarize that conversation, but I do think, you know, you've been at pains to say, you know, you've learned things all the way through your career about good and bad leadership. You've certainly taken a lot from the sporting side of your background and applied it, which I think is fascinating. And I think a lot of people who are into sport will see those parallels, whatever their sport is. I don't think it's obviously just judo, and I can certainly see that in the stuff that I've done. But it's been a real pleasure, and I think we probably have to continue, have a second half to this conversation sometime in the future. So thank you very much.
Thank you.